This is Greg Corumbus of Radio America reporting for WorldNet Daily. My guest at this time is John Gizzi, political editor at Human Events, the National Conservative Weekly. And John, always great to have you with us.
Always great to be here. It's a nice escape from 98-degree weather.
It certainly is. Could be the hottest day of the year here in Washington today. But another man taking a lot of heat this week is General Stanley McChrystal, no longer the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan. It all unraveled in the span of about 48 hours, really, when we learned that he had made some comments very critical about various members of the president's national security team to Rolling Stone magazine. We learned that Rolling Stone actually gave the general the chance to vet the article. He didn't have any problems with it. He had gone after Joe Biden, the national security advisor, General Jones, the ambassador to Afghanistan, Eikenberry, and basically he was summoned here to Washington. The president accepted his resignation and replaces him with David Petraeus. Any surprises about how this was handled once we knew what the story was?
Well, you forgot Richard Holbrooke, the president's appointment in Afghanistan, who was on the McChrystal hate list.
Absolutely. But what do you make of how it was handled once we knew what was going on?
Well, it had to happen. I did not doubt at all that General McChrystal would have to go, in large part because virtually every general, no matter how popular he is or how successful his campaign is, once he makes a public break with the president and the civilian government, he must go. And that has been a trend that's gone back to Abraham Lincoln and General McClellan during the Civil War, up through Harry Truman and Douglas MacArthur, and more recently with other generals been replaced, including at least one of the five predecessors to General David Petraeus, who will be our new man in Afghanistan. McChrystal cannot blame a press officer or the very devious record of Rolling Stone in his comments if he vetted the remarks. He knew what he was doing, and he had to be out. Now, as for General Petraeus coming in, the president played a very good hand. He drew to a pair of aces and won. David Petraeus is probably the nation's best-liked, most respected man in uniform. His operation in Iraq, particularly with the emphasis on counterinsurgency, makes him probably the one general who could replace McChrystal without a barrage of brickbats coming from congressional Republicans and other Obama appointments. As for what the future holds for General McChrystal, one does not know. I would say if there really was any chance of David Petraeus running for president next year, he's lost considerable time by accepting this assignment from the commander-in-chief he might have run against.
John, I know you talked to a lot of members of Congress about this yesterday and the day before. I would agree that most of them would certainly come to the conclusion that what he said was a severe breach of protocol. What about the content of the comments? Any reaction from members of Congress about whether the general's criticisms were valid?
Virtually everyone who's weighed in on this begins with the statements that perhaps it was a little impolite for a general to be talking so frankly, and also that he should not sit down with that paragon of journalistic ethics, Rolling Stone. That said, what McChrystal said in his content is usually backed up by members of Congress, in particular about the administration's distance, something he emphasized from their commander and from the operation in the war that the president says he is committed to. And I think this is going to prompt a lot of discussion. Certainly the talking heads will have a field day with it over the weekend. They'll probably be more engaged in that than anything except the U.S. playing the United Kingdom in the World Cup.
It was runoff day in South Carolina and North Carolina on Tuesday. We also had the U.S. Senate primary in Utah. Let's go through them one at a time. No surprise, once we saw the original primary results a couple of weeks ago, but Nikki Haley, the state assembly member in South Carolina, easily winning the Republican nomination over Congressman Gresham Barrett. What do you make of her campaign thus far and her likelihood of winning in November?
Well, she's the Republican Barack Obama. She came out of nowhere. She captivated people's imaginations. And with perhaps the slimmest resume of any of the candidates, but the most fresh and vibrant message, she won rather easily. And I might add, she spent the least money of the major candidates. She's very likely to beat Democrat Vince Sheehan in November, and I think perhaps go on to be South Carolina's first woman governor and the nation's second Indian-American governor.
Well, John, let's move to another critical election, and that's out in Utah. We were shocked just a few weeks ago when Republicans didn't even put Bob Bennett back on the ballot for a potential fourth term in the U.S. Senate. In the end, Lee is the nominee by a narrow margin out there. Is he a shoo-in for November?
Yes. Democrats had guessed that Bennett would be the candidate, and no one foresaw the internecine battle on the Republican side. So all Lee has to do to win is to stay alive. I've spent some time with Mike Lee. His father, Rex Lee, was Ronald Reagan's Solicitor General, and he himself is a very bright constitutional lawyer. It was his belief that Supreme Court decisions were enhancing the role of government in our daily lives that led him to get into politics. He is foursquare in favor of abolishing the Department of Education, and he opposes raising the liability cap for BP. He's very fearless and will be an outspoken conservative voice and someone to keep our eye on.
Runoff in North Carolina. Elaine Marshall is now the Democratic nominee to take on Republican Senator Richard Burr in November. How tight or not tight will that race be this year?
Well, certainly everyone pays attention to North Carolina because Democrat Kay Hagan unseated Republican Elizabeth Dole in a big upset, and the state has not had a Republican governor in 20 years. Richard Burr is someone who keeps his ear to the ground and his finger on the pulse of the people, and I do believe he will survive.
John, let's move on to the issue that's been consuming Washington for most of the past couple of months, and that's the massive oil leak in the Gulf of Mexico. The president delivered a setback this week from a federal judge in New Orleans that reversed his moratorium on deepwater offshore drilling, the White House vowing to appeal immediately. But how does this change the equation and the debate over drilling?
Well, already BP is drilling very close to the Alaskan shore, and I'm not sure if this is a result of the decision, but it will also mean that oil companies will not necessarily have to go way away from the shore and 5,000 feet below the ground. That was a big problem with BP. The environmental constraints forced them to go in an area that was unknown territory. And that's why we can only send robots down and not divers to deal with this problem. My guess is that it just may give BP the opportunity to redeem itself by getting it right when it comes to drilling. And maybe we just will not have to stop drilling altogether everywhere because of a very unfortunate accident and a mistake, albeit the fault of the company, that it is trying its best to alleviate.
John, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for your time, as always.
Staying indoors and waiting for the U.S. to win on Saturday, I'm John Gizzi.
John Gizzi, political editor at Human Events, the National Conservative Weekly. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, reporting for WorldNet Daily.